Hello, you're watching Global Investor on Business Day TV. I'm Simon Brown. Caroline Creeman from AdviceWorks joins me this evening in studio to guide us through all the latest news on global markets. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Sahil Suleman from Coronation to discuss their Global Emerging Markets Fund. All that way coming your way shortly. First, a quick look at what's been making headlines. The U.S. Federal Reserve lifted interest rates by 0.25% to 2%. This is the U.S. economy is growing faster than expected, with rapid growth creating the dollar approaches a seven-month high. The Fed signaled two more likely increases for this year. Meanwhile, the European Central Bank has announced that it will end its stimulus program by December and will possibly hike rates next year. On to some company news. Comcast and Disney have expressed interest in purchasing 21st Century Fox assets. Comcast has put in a bid of $65 billion for the entertainment assets, which the Fox board agreed to sell to Walt Disney last year. Fox will have to request a waiver from Disney to begin talks with Comcast, who says that the new improved offer fully addresses the board's stated concerns with the previous bid. And AT&T won approval from the U.S. court to buy Time Warner for $85 billion U.S. dollars, dealing a blow to U.S. President Donald Trump's administration, which tried to block the deal, which will likely set off a wave of corporate mergers. Here's more on that.
A big win for AT&T on Tuesday, a U.S. court giving it a green light for its mammoth $85 billion purchase of Time Warner. The telecom giant's win is a big loss for the U.S. Department of Justice, which filed a lawsuit last year. The government was against the deal, claiming one company shouldn't control phone, broadband, DirecTV, satellite programming, and Time Warner's TV, video, and movie content. President Donald Trump has been a strong opponent of the deal, first announced in October 2016. Specifically, Trump has been intensely critical of news coverage by Time Warner, CNN. The merger is the fourth largest deal ever attempted in the global telecom media and entertainment space. For AT&T, it's about growth. While the Justice Department can still appeal, the judge, in a scathing opinion, urged the U.S. government not to seek a stay of his ruling, saying it would be, quote, manifestly unjust to do so and not likely to succeed. Time Warner shares rose more than 5% late Tuesday, with the blockbuster deal moving one step closer to the finish line.
Caroline Creeman from AdviceWorks joins me now. Caroline, let's pick up on the AT&T story there. This is a giant deal, and I can't keep and I have going back to the AOL Time Warner, which was the giant deal of a different era, which fundamentally didn't work. In a sense, you can see how this fits. On one side, you've got AT&T, the carrier and the like. You've got Time Warner, the content. You can see them fitting together. They said that last time, but it does make some sense, perhaps.
Look, I think it's a little bit different to last time. So I think the last time they tried something like this was really in the time when people were still watching television.
Fair point.
And
internet was dial-up.
Exactly. So really, probably this is the time where this has come. And you're going to see this increasingly where your content carriers are looking to pick up, because they're really just dumb pipes.
Sure.
You know, they're a utility, looking to pick up content because that is where the revenue pickup is. So I think the regulatory environment is certainly favorable to them. You know, people are concerned about the rise of Netflix and Amazon. And, you know, this is a way to create competition with those players, even though they're almost not quite as big as this deal.
It's a fair point because, I mean, we'll touch on in a moment. Disney and Comcast won 21st Century Fox. Verizon has bought AOL and old Yahoo assets as well. Yes, obviously, this is the old school guys trying to compete with the new school guys, except that they've got the content. You know, they've got the library. They've got, I mean, if we look at potential, you know, Disney or however that ties up, they've got that content. Yes. Netflix is perhaps in a slightly vulnerable place here because Disney can say, all that lovely Disney content, it fails.
Well, I mean, this is part of the neutrality issues that have been raised in the U.S. And in a way, Donald Trump has actually been saying one thing on the one hand and doing something on the other. And on the other hand, on the one hand, he did away with some of the net neutrality rules that Obama had actually put into place. And on the other hand, he is critical of this deal. So it looks at these like the courts are looking more towards, you know, what you're saying, net neutrality is not an issue at this point. I presume that if it becomes an issue at some stage where there is, where somebody tries to, like an AT&T tries to throttle content from Netflix, or probably more likely from a news channel, this is probably where the issues are going to, the repercussions are going to come, that the regulators will start to actually clamp down on that. But for the time being, they're letting the free market take its course.
Yeah, fair point. This is a free market. And then, of course, there's another potential one here, Sprint and T-Mobile, who are number 3 and 4 in the telco space, have wanted to tie up before. And this looks like, certainly after the AT&T and Time Warner, they might get it past the DOJ, Department of Justice. And that might then actually give America, because at the moment it's much like in South Africa, our number 3 and 4 are so far behind.
Yeah, they're tiny. And even combined, I think they make up about a third of Verizon and AT&T. So it's quite interesting because that is actually obviously a horizontal acquisition. But Sprint has had its issues. SoftBank had to step in there, and I think it's the first time for a very long time that they've actually had a positive quarter. T-Mobile, you know, it needs somebody, you know, to create a bit of critical mass to compete with the Verizons and the AT&Ts. And both of these players really want to go into the 5G market, and they need investment. They need they need enough capital to actually start to invest in that.
Yeah, get the capex, get the towers, everywhere. Quickly before we move on, we were chatting before we came on air. Everyone I speak to loves Disney. Do you love Disney?
I love Disney.
Both the movies and the share.
I love the movies and the share and the theme parks. I love the mouse. I love everything about it. I think it's very undervalued at this point. I think this deal will be good for them, but even if it doesn't go through, Disney's still got so much intellectual property. It's well managed. I know there are issues at this point with ESPN and the revenue coming from there, but you know, then if you're discounting ESPN, you're discounting Disney's management ability to try to turn the sports into streamable content, which they're certainly doing. So I don't think count this one out. I think it's at, trading at a wonderful valuation right now.
Yeah, agreed. And I think I think ESPN will get it right. The random fact for the day is that 20th Century Fox owns Star Wars 1. For some strange reason, George Lucas gave it to them. Disney owns the rest, won Star Wars 1. Yeah. Next, going to the Fed and the ECB. Interest rate increase, no surprise. Perhaps the only slight surprise is that maybe they're going to be a little more aggressive in terms of, you know, we were talking 3 or 4 increases this year. It looks like 4. Yeah. It looks like maybe 3 next year. That starts to take us to some chunky rates.
Yes, it does. And I think people have forgotten what those rates look like. And I think, but this is part of what is roiling the emerging markets at this point. You know, people are scratching their heads looking at what the implication is. And I think, look, it's not great for very indebted U.S. companies. So this Time Warner deal, you know, they're taking on a lot of debt. So that, you know, they have to get it right, because otherwise it's going to be a very, very big issue with this deal. But, you know, emerging market debt denominated in dollars, you're going to see a lot of emerging market friction in the next few months.
Yeah, and we also potentially, I mean, as that rate rises, and at 2%, we're still historically low, but one day it's at 3, one day it's at 4, what we will start to see is money moving into the debt market to get their good old-fashioned lock and 4%, you know, with practically no risk. Not so much.
Potentially, but you know, just remember that the increasing interest rates also increases the risk of default. So
careful where you put the money.
You've got to be very careful where you put the money.
Fair point. Correct. I mean, 4% on T-bills might not be the most thrilling thing. Yeah. The ECB, Draghi talking last week, he manages the market brilliantly. Yes. The fact that they're moving into tapering, the fact that they might have some increases by summer of next year, but maybe not, says to me, much like when the U.S. started this part of the process 3 years ago, that Europe's coming right.
I don't think so. I think they're in a very different position. I wouldn't be surprised if they actually kind of stretch us out a bit longer. Europe has not made the structural reforms that the U.S. had. That economic growth is looking very feeble now. You've got an issue with Italy, and also their banks don't look as stable as the U.S. banks. They really don't. And I mean, the American banks are starting to pay record dividends. They're having share buybacks. So they've got such a healthy financial system. You don't have the same thing in the EU. So I think if he is going to cut back on stimulus, he's going to do it really slowly. And if growth continues like it is, I wonder if he's not going to stretch it out a little bit.
It's a fair point. I mean, Janet Yellen, we had QE1, we had QE2, we had QE kitchen sink, as much as it takes. And maybe that's, you know, Draghi with all the best intention might come to September, October and say, sorry, folks.
Growth could derail this. I mean, a lack of growth could derail it. An Italian crisis could derail this. So don't put money in the bank. This is actually the process they're going to take.
Okay, yeah. So what about trade wars? Could they derail it? Because I'm honest, I know where we stand on trade wars as of about 2 hours ago, where apparently on the 6th of July, Trump will impose trade wars in China. China has promised to retaliate.
Yes.
Trump has promised that if they do retaliate, he will give more trade wars.
Yes.
And this just ends in tears.
And then somewhere Justin Trudeau from Canada got the truck sucked in as well. I'm not exactly sure how. Look, I think there's a lot of talk at this point. I said on the previous program, look, I think Trump is bright enough not to cause a complete trade war. I think it's a lot of rhetoric. And he probably thinks it's the right time to shake the Chinese down when the economy is actually doing quite well, that if there is some type of knock on the economy, can absorb it. But if you look at business confidence in figures out of the U.S., it is starting to have an impact on business confidence, which, of course, affects investing, which is going to have a negative impact on GDP growth. So there comes a point where even if you're not having an all-out trade war, you are negatively impacting your economy, and I think he's almost reaching that tipping point.
So how do you play it at advice books? Are you more bottom-up, and you know what, if it's a great company, it's a great company?
Look, it is a great company, it's a great company, but you also need to be aware that there are some areas that are a little bit more risky than others, and right now I think, look, commodities for me are like a sitting duck for these types of tariffs and things like that, agriculture as well, emerging markets as well. So you try to, you know, be where people are still going to be spending money.
Yeah, so back to Disney, because they're going to be at the movies and the trade
wars.
Oil, Iran's saying some OPEC members are going to veto the Saudi proposed supply cut. Oil is off the highs, but still quite high at that point.
Correct.
Trade wars might have impacts in terms of China and the U.S., but oil's looking maybe higher for longer?
It does look, well, look, I think that probably Saudis and Russia will be able to get more supply out there. I think that if you look at the people who are opposing this, it's Iran, Venezuela, and Iraq. These are people who really need those high oil prices. I don't think they've got enough votes to actually derail what is very likely going to happen in the end of the week, I think, on Friday.
Yeah. It's Friday. Mm. It's not the issue. So, I mean, we talk in global markets, we touch on the US, they're, you know, nice, good markets. I mean, that's what Powell was saying last week, and we can largely concur with that. But we bring the rising rates perhaps coming through, we bring perhaps some trade wars, you mentioned resources, we bring oil. For the emerging market, global markets, it's not looking so pretty. We, of course, fall into that.
Exactly.
And we're going to talk to our guests in a moment about more, but it's looking a little rocky out there.
Yeah, and you didn't mention, you know, the rising political risk as well. You're seeing populist governments rise everywhere. Mexico is probably going to go that route. Brazil's probably going to go that route. You know, Erdogan will probably still stay with Turkey, but, you know, he's just made some very anti-market comments. So, unfortunately, as South Africans, and I tell my clients, you know, they always say, you know, South African political risks, that people don't look at South African political risks if you're outside of the country. You look at emerging market risks.
Yeah,
and we're just, whatever's happening here, we're getting smacked with the emerging market pattern.
And therefore, US dollar almost at 7 month highs again. We can probably see that to continue.
The flip of that is
our currency's weakening.
It's going to continue because the US is, I mean, it's growing faster than Europe. And also, it's still a flight to safety.
Yeah.
You know, people always say, look, the dollar shouldn't be the reserve currency of the world. But in reality, when, you know, the something hits the fan, everybody runs to the dollar.
We can say it shouldn't, but the truth
it shouldn't
of the matter
be, but it is.
It's a long way. The euro is almost 20. It's a long 20 years old. It's a long way from the euro, and it's even a longer way. Those of you who are screaming Bitcoin at us, Bitcoin is even longer.
No, all gold.
All gold. Gold's never been. We're going to go for a short break. When we come back, we'll take a look at the Coronation Global Emerging Markets Fund. This is Hill Solomon. Don't go away. Welcome back. You're watching Global Investor. Still with me in studio, Caroline Creeman from AdviceWorks. And joining us on the line to discuss the Coronation Global Emerging Markets Fund is co-fund manager Sahel Solomon. Sahel, good evening. Thanks for joining us on the line. I want to delve into some of the specifics around the fund, but the one thing that really did catch me, and I'm not sure if it's fund-specific or if it's a coronation philosophy, in the how long should investors remain invested, you're very much saying, really, this is long-term, and you're saying long-term is 10 years. Oftentimes, folks are saying long-term is 5 years, and I'm old school. To me, 10 years really is it. Is it more the fund, or is it a coronation philosophy?
I mean, obviously, you know, coronation's philosophy is very long-term in nature, so we would always talk about investment periods of 5 years or longer. But particularly for an equity fund which exhibits high degree of volatility like an emerging markets fund, and emerging markets are significantly more volatile than developed markets or global markets as a whole, we believe 10 years is a more reasonable time period as a time horizon. The annual volatility of the GEM index is far in excess of that of developed markets. Of course, with that comes the potential for greater return. But you do need to be prepared to be invested for 5 years or longer, and preferably 10 years or more. And you can see over the course of the last 10.5 years that we've had our emerging markets fund up and running, certainly the retail version that's available to South African retail investors, you've had wild swings in NAV over that period. The first half of the fund's existence was very much characterized by a commodity bull market in places like Brazil and South Africa, and high oil prices and gold prices and platinum prices, and a lot of that is reversed over the last 5 years. And that's how we feel that, if you really want to get the full benefit of being exposed to emerging markets, you should be prepared to be invested for longer periods of time than you would typically get for a normal equity fund, where 5 years can often be sufficient for capturing alpha.
Yeah, and what's important here, although you're investing in emerging markets, you're happy to buy companies, and I mean British American Tobacco is your big holder, your argument being that they're earning a significant amount of their earnings in emerging markets, therefore it's happy to be in here. You're not looking for 100% EM in every stock.
No, but I mean you make reference to what we would consider to be multinationals, which earn at a minimum of 40% or more of their revenue or profits from emerging markets, and BAT is an example of that. That is capped at 25% of fund. And the underlying philosophy is really people are quite happy to own a Taiwanese chip maker like TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Company, or a company like Samsung Electronics, which makes chips which are sold to all over the world, or fancy cell phones which are sold all over the world. I don't actually have a very large exposure to emerging markets within them. An investor who wants to get access to the good things that happen in emerging markets, rising wealth levels, rising financial penetration, increased consumer spending, there's no reason why philosophically they should be averse to holding a global multinational which has a very good exposure to emerging markets. But as I mentioned, the percentage of fund that can be exposed to those types of companies is capped at 25%. And then simplistically, if those companies are earning, let's say, half the earnings from emerging markets, and you're at your absolute maximum of 25%, you've basically got 88 to 90% exposure to true emerging markets over the cycle.
Okay. You mentioned consumers there. The one thing that stands out is your consumer discretionary at just over 28%, your consumer staples at almost 24%, half the fund focused on the consumer. This is the emerging, I imagine, middle-class growing consumer base in these emerging markets, and it is going to be stocks such as British American Tobacco and others.
Yes, I mean, I suppose the really exciting thing about emerging markets is that the consumption levels of most things we would consider to be normal, even in a country like South Africa, which is far more developed than many of the emerging market peers, is well behind developed market levels. And then over and above that, a lot of the industries themselves are a lot more fragmented compared to South African equivalents. We often refer to South Africa as being an emerging market, but we actually exhibit characteristics which are more in line with developed markets. Just by way of example, our top couple of banks, the Big Four plus Investec and Capitec, probably have 98% of the total loan book in the entire country. Our top food retailers, the names probably make up 60 to 70% of total food retail exposure in South Africa. Whereas if you go to emerging markets, they're probably where South Africa was 30, 40 years ago, very much further behind the development curve. Number one food retailer in Russia, which is in the fund, has 9% market share. The number two has 8% market share. And we've seen over the course of many, many years, these businesses, over long periods of time, can compound their earnings both through organic growth and through consolidating and taking out weaker competitors. And that's really what we're looking for to make up the bulk of the fund. Because you look at the emerging market index, and there's a lot out there that we consider to be uninvestable, or at least very difficult to have a very high level of conviction on the long-term earnings power. I mean, you've got chemical companies, you've got materials businesses, you've got power distributors. competitors. You've got banks which are operating in very fragmented industries with regulators who are prone to irrational moves. You've got a large amount of commodities. So really that's what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to give people an exposure to things you can't get in South Africa. Because, I mean, if you want a materials business or an oil business, you can buy Sasol here. You'll be looking for something different in emerging markets, something you can't get in South Africa.
Caroline, that's a good point. I mean, as South Africans, I take Sahil's point that we're not a classic emerging market, but most South African investors are perhaps overexposed to it just because, you know, Reg 28, our retirements and the like. And we've got to be perhaps careful and how we get that balance within a portfolio, because we are, notwithstanding, we could make the argument that our banks are not really emerging market.
Well, I think we like to think we're not an emerging market, but we really are. We were stuck in that, which you know brings me to my question. So, Hale, I'm curious as to why the second biggest holding in countries is actually South Africa. It's ahead of India at 12%. We're at 17%. Why was that done? Did you not think that you know rather to take companies that aren't in South Africa as part of a South African fund?
I think it's more a function of the country of listing as opposed to being true underlying exposure to the African economy. So if you look at our exposure to South Africa over the vast majority of the time since inception, it's been to Naspers. And as everyone listening will know, Naspers today is basically worth less than the value of its 10-cent stake, and you know, we've done very well out of it. You know, when you buy Naspers today, as much as you might have DSTV and a whole bunch of classified businesses throughout the rest of the world, you're ultimately buying exposures to Tencent. And we feel that the discount that you get on Tencent's valuation when buying Naspers is very attractive. Tencent, in our view, is probably around fairly valued, maybe slightly overvalued. And our philosophy is to buy stocks that offer a substantial margin of safety. If you could buy it at a 30% discount just to the value of its 10-cent stake, then Naspers is very attractive. So, you know, historically, we've actually not owned much domestic SA exposure. There's been times we've had small exposure to some of the food retailers and clothing retailers here, but the vast majority has been in Naspers. And you mentioned British American Tobacco. It shows up as South Africa simply because we own the South African listing. It's not really pure South African exposure. Those two would account for the vast majority of the SA exposure you see in the fact sheet.
You, during the period, you write that you pulled back some of your Nike exposure, or Nike as one pronounces it, added Adidas to it. Is that very much a play on valuations rather than a call on Adidas is perhaps the future winner between the two?
It's very much valuation. If you look historically, if you went back to 2012, 2013, we owned both of them for a prolonged period of time, but Nike outperformed Adidas operationally significantly. Then we sold out of Nike and we held Adidas for a little bit longer, but then you know, Adidas also reached fair value. But you know, both businesses continue to compound their earnings year after year at a very decent rate. What's interesting about the two of them is although you know, Adidas is number two in most markets, Adidas does have a greater margin opportunity. You know, Nike historically has earned margins well in excess of 10%, mostly due to its very strong position in the U.S. market, whereas Adidas, being a little bit more geographically dispersed, has earned single-digit margins. And over the last couple of years, Adidas has been you know, cleaning up, selling off some of their non-core assets. They own the Reebok brand, which doesn't make much money. They paid a lot for it back, I think, in 2005. And all of that is starting to come through now. So if you look at the, you know, the near-term valuations, you know, Nike and Adidas don't look too different from each other in terms of the one-year forward or two-year forward multiple. But if you go out 3 or 4 years, you know, Nike has potential to raise its margins by a couple of percent. Adidas, there's no reason why it should be earning half the margins of Nike. So that multiple comes down much more rapidly. So it's very much a play on valuation. Now, we did very well out of Nike. We bought it, I think, at the end of 2015, under $50 a share. You know, today it's trading in the mid-70s. You know, that would argue for a reduced position anyway.
Quickly before we've got about a minute or so left, you added some South Korean financial services group, not a stock I know anything about. My question is more, do you concern yourself with geopolitical? Obviously, there was the meeting in Singapore last week, or are you going to be very much exclusively a bottom-up, and if it's a quality stock, it's a quality stock?
I mean, you can't ignore geopolitics and you can't ignore macro. I suppose the short answer is that macro has an impact on year one, year two, year three earnings. But in the longer term, you tend to make money out of businesses that you know increase their earnings year after year over a long period of time. And then that's the reason why we have some of the Korean domestic exposure. You're never going to be protected against a nuclear attack on South Korea. But if you just look at the sheer scale, the difference in economic size between North Korea and South Korea, you know, let's say the countries are unified tomorrow, it will be a drop in the ocean. South Korea is, 100 times the size of North Korea. It's a completely developed, advanced economy, whereas North Korea is very much, 1930s, 1940s levels of development.
Yeah, the other stock I wanted to touch on, but we are out of time, I think. Ping An Insurance, obviously a discovery play. Yeah. We can, as South Africans, get some interesting little bits here and there, but my sense is it's always, apart from Naspers and British Milk Tobacco Caroline, it always does seem a little bit
spotty. Yeah.
Yeah, spotty and small, perhaps.
I think if you're buying Discovery now, you're not buying it for Ping An. Although I think in future,
it might very well be the other way. That's the show for this week. My thanks to our guest, Caroline Creeman from AdviceWorks, Suhail Suleiman, who is co-fund manager of the Coronation Global Emerging Markets Fund. Thanks you for watching. I'll catch you again same time next week. Have a good evening.